Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, an Israeli embassy official has been caught on camera plotting to take down British MPs regarded as hostile. Senior political officer Shai Massett was recorded by an undercover reporter from Al Jazeera making comments about several politicians, including the Foreign Office Minister, Alan Duncan. We hear from journalist Issa Winstanley this hour. Turkey and Iraq have come to an agreement over the presence of Turkish forces in northern Iraq. After months of diplomatic wrestling over the issue, it appears likely that at last the two countries can focus on the fight against Daesh. But will it really be that simple, or will Ankara's military presence in Iraq continue to be a bone of contention? One of the most vocal and high-profile populist parties in Europe, Italy's Five Star Movement, is set to split from the anti-EU political alliance at the European Parliament and join the pro-EU ALDE grouping in a move that will see funding for pro-Brexit UKIP slashed. But does the move also signal the demise of Euroscepticism, and how much will it undermine UKIP both politically and financially? Germany has threatened to end development aid to countries that refuse to take back rejected asylum seekers. The warning is a response to the failure to deport the suspected Berlin attacker to Tunisia. It comes at a time of growing debate in the country over issues of security and immigration. And how one Texan man found out the hard way that you shouldn't keep cat litter in your car. All that and more over the next hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus. An Israeli embassy official has been caught on camera plotting to take down MPs who were regarded as hostile. Shai Massett, who describes himself as an officer in the Israel Defence Force and is serving as a senior political officer at the London embassy, was recorded by an undercover reporter for Al Jazeera. Foreign Office Minister Sir Alan Duncan, an outspoken supporter of a Palestinian state, was among those Massett was heard to be plotting against. The Israeli ambassador, Mark Rajev, has apologised, insisting that Massett was just a junior official in the embassy. Liam O'Hare has more.
Well, the revelations that emerged yesterday come as a result of a six-month investigation into the extent of the Israel lobby's influence within the United Kingdom. And earlier, to discuss this further, I was joined by the journalist Asa Winstanley from the Electronic Intifada. I began by asking him to explain just what we know so far about the man at the centre of the allegations, Shai Massett.
OK, so what we know is that he is some sort of agent for the Israeli embassy in London. He's been presenting himself for the last few years as a senior political officer from the embassy. Yeah, senior political officer, that's the quote. That's what he had on his business card, according to The Guardian. And, you know, in all of his appearances at pro-Israel meetings, such as Liberal Democrats, Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, other groups like that. I mean, you know, there's still traces over it all over the internet. It's senior political officer.
And do we think, like, in terms of the meetings that he's had and the remarks that he's made, is there any suggestion that he was working as part of a wider strategy, or do you think it's possible that he was just this kind of lone wolf working of his own volition?
He's absolutely working as part of the Israeli government's strategy to undermine Palestine solidarity, to increase its political influence within all the UK's political parties. This sort of flack that's come from the Israeli government and its apologists yesterday that he was just sort of a junior temporary hire is a load of nonsense. I mean, this guy is set up so that in order they can distance themselves from him should something like this happen. The really interesting thing to me, and I wrote about this in my article, it hasn't really been picked up that much yet, but I'm hoping we'll gain some traction, is this. Technically, when the Israeli embassy is saying he's not a diplomat, they're telling the truth on a technicality because he's not on the diplomatic list. Okay, so he's not on the diplomatic list of, you know, what that means is every embassy has got lists of, the British government keeps lists of every embassy of diplomats who are accredited to that embassy, right? Shai Massett is not on that list, and he hasn't been. He never has been, as far as I can tell. So technically, he's not a diplomat. However, the Israeli embassy was presenting him as a diplomat to everyone he was working with. So who was he really? Who was he really working for? There's reasons to believe it's likely that he was working for one of Israel's spy agencies, in my judgment.
Because as well, looking into his background as well, I know he worked with the Israeli army in Gaza in some kind of diplomatic role, or at least that was the way it was being presented. So it's not really a kind of junior rank of officer that we're talking about here, is it? This is somebody who seems at least to have served in quite high positions in both Israel and now in the UK.
You're absolutely right. If you talk to anyone in the mainstream pro-Palestinian campaigning organisations, they're familiar with this guy. So, I mean, I was at Labour Party conference in September. The people in Labour Friends of Palestine and these Palestine Solidarity campaign and the pro-Israel groups, they were familiar with this guy, Shem Masut, from the Israeli embassy. You know, he was there. He's a political officer at the Israeli embassy. He's a mover and a shaker. You know, he's arranging things. There's footage of him from the Al Jazeera documentary that's been released so far, of him sitting next to Jeremy Newmark of the Jewish Labour Movement, for example, and Mark Regev, the ambassador. This is not some rogue intern by any means.
What do you make of the response of the British government? Because they've already came out and said, I think the matter is closed as far as they are concerned. Does that surprise you at all?
Doesn't surprise me, but I don't think this line is going to be able to hold. The Labour Party, Emily Thornberry, has come out and said there should be an investigation, and the Scottish National Party's Alex Salmond has gone further, said there should be an investigation and Masut should be expelled immediately before his term that was already going to end ends. So I think it's going to be difficult for the government to hold on to this line, especially when more revelations from the film come out on Sunday, when the first part of the film is actually broadcast. It's going to be very uncomfortable viewing for the Tory government and for many in the right and the pro-Israel wing of the Labour Party too.
That was Asa Winstanley, journalist with the website The Electronic Intifada. And earlier I also spoke to the Israeli professor Niamh Gordon. I asked him if he was surprised by the UK government's response to the allegations.
Well, it's clear that the relationship is very cosy, and I think this is a great embarrassment to Israel, because probably been doing things like Shai has been doing for many years. Once they are under the limelight, it is an embarrassment. And I think we know that Theresa May supports Netanyahu and his government and his policies, and I don't think that she wants an incident like this to get in the way, because they are ideological allies, both in terms of their ideologies towards the neoliberal market and in terms of their ideologies towards immigrants and so forth.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It is 8 minutes past the hour. After months of diplomatic tussle, both Iraq and Turkey have come to an agreement on the presence of Turkish troops in northern Iraq. During a meeting in Baghdad on Saturday between Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi and Turkish Prime Minister Bin Ali Yildirim, Ankara promised to, quote, respect the sovereignty of Iraq. Back in October, Abadi accused Turkey of violating Iraq's sovereignty when Turkish forces moved into the northern city of Bashika, just northeast of Mosul, without an invitation from the central Iraqi government, allegedly to help in the fight against Daesh. The situation was worsened when Turkish President Erdogan claimed that Mosul is part of Turkey. For more on what this means for Iraq-Turkey relations, here's Matthew Aiton.
Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said on Saturday that an agreement has been reached with Turkey over the status of Turkish forces in northern Iraq. Turkey moved its forces into the northern Iraqi town of Bashika and in other areas in October without the permission of the central Iraqi government in Baghdad, resulting in Baghdad accusing Turkey of violating its sovereignty. Turkey has now agreed to, quote, respect the sovereignty of Iraq and not to interfere in Iraq's domestic affairs. Abadi said after a meeting with his Turkish counterpart Bin Ali Yildirim in Baghdad that, quote, the Turkish Prime Minister and the delegation accompanying him confirmed that this issue will be solved in a satisfactory manner soon. Well, joining us now to discuss this in further detail is Turkey analyst and journalist Ilhan Tanir. Mr. Tanir, thank you for talking to us. Can you just start by explaining for us what you think Turkey's motivation was for crossing into Iraq in the first place?
Well, I mean, Turkey has been stationed in various bases in northern Iraq for a long time. But that Bashika base was obviously important. I think it was about little more than a year ago Turkey declared that it sent new reinforcements against the ISIS, but obviously the ISIS anti-ISIS coalition led by U.S. and including Iraqi government have been opposing to the idea. Obviously, Turkey's move there, sending reinforcements, seen especially by Baghdad as a de facto intervention without getting any kind of consent from Baghdad government. And it was seen as Turkey's own intervention rather than coordinated efforts against ISIS.
Sure, obviously Baghdad said that it was a violation of Iraq's sovereignty, didn't they?
Yes, exactly. But if you are asking me why Turkey did this, I can only speculate. Other than the official remarks, it seemed like Turkey wanted to step in against PKK presence in northern Iraq.
That's what I wanted to ask you next. Do you think that this meeting between Haider al-Abadi and Binali Yildirim is a sign of a genuine easing of tensions between the two countries, or is it just a standard diplomatic procedure, do you think?
As far as we can see, it is not officially announced, but both countries, unnamed officials, local media, suggesting that Iraq gave its word to Ankara that they're going to get PKK militants out of Shingal, which is very important for Turkey, and in return, Turkey is going to withdraw from Başika. This is, again, not announced. Turkish Prime Minister did not say that, but it seems like this kind of agreement is in the making. If that was the case, if both countries can follow up on these promises, I think that can be a new page for the relations. But I think it's still too early to know whether indeed this latest visit can open a new page.
Sure. President Erdogan previously made quite an incendiary comment by saying or proclaiming Turkey's historical right to the Mosul province. And some commentators have suggested that that's why Turkey moved into the Başika and surrounding areas. Do you agree with that?
Well, certainly that rhetoric was very popular in Turkey a couple months ago. Turkey, especially Turkish media that was affiliated with the government, and many of the talking heads and the pundits have been pumping the idea that it's about time for Turkey to take back some of the territories lost 100 years ago, not only northern Iraq but also northern Syria, including sometimes Aleppo. Well, that was certainly one of the rhetoric, and that worked within the country. But when it comes to international law and understandings, I don't know how much the Turkish president was serious about taking Mosul back. But certainly Turkey wanted to have a say in the Mosul fight, and Turkey thinks that the Sunni regional force, as it was classified recently by Ankara's rhetoric, Turkey has an important role in Mosul fight for the Sunnis in the region. So I think it was mostly rhetoric and populist agenda within Turkey. But other than that, I really do not think Turkey seriously, at least the near term, is going to, attempt to take over Mosul for real.
Sure. And just finally, many have, of course, lambasted Turkey for its conduct in Iraq, saying that it's violated Iraqi sovereignty. But, of course, Iran has also got a presence in Iraq, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, for example. So can we really say that Turkey's presence is any worse?
Actually, no. I mean, there's a great point. The problem is that you don't see these kind of aggressive and non-diplomatic talking points and remarks coming out of Tehran. You know, Tehran is trying to do its business silently, very carefully, not provoking anyone. Yes, there are officials, always there are officials within the Iranian government or state or security apparatus, some commanders within the Quds force, always one gets to hear different tones and sectarian remarks, but you don't really see this coming out of president, even though also the Rouhani leader had that kind of rhetoric time to time. But Turkey, Turkish president, especially in 2016, really went off the rail, left any kind of diplomatic politeness, or you didn't really see any careful carelessness in these remarks. You keep seeing that. That's one part that really made Turkey stick in the region. It really made Turkey as if, trying to take over part of the Iraq or part of the Syria or, try. So, my point is that, yes, Iran certainly, both in Syria and in Iraq, I think have been very openly actually pursuing sectarian agenda. I think very much you can see their policies within the realm of Shia agenda, but they do that with the consent of the Syrian government as well as Baghdad government. They are having better relations with them, so they don't really have that kind of a backlash from either of the capitals. But when it comes to Ankara, Ankara is trying to do this with fighting with the Baghdad and Damascus, and it looks like certainly in neither of these countries, Turkey's policies are not working well.
Okay, Ilhan Tanir, very interesting stuff. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, almost two centuries on since Britain took control of the Falkland Malvinas Isles in the South Atlantic, and the sovereignty dispute with Argentina still rages on. But given the 1982 Falklands War and a subsequent referendum in which 99.8% of islanders voted to remain British, has Argentine repatriation become an unfeasible nationalistic shibboleth? We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again!
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Ha! Do you have access to a radio?
Yeah, it's me, Max Kaiser. I'm here with Stacey Herbert. We have a new show on Sputnik called Double Down. It's business, finance, economics, ka-ching, bling, and everything in between. That's Double Down on Sputnik. Tune in!
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case. Simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, almost two centuries on since Britain took control of the Falkland Malvinas Isles in the South Atlantic, and the sovereignty dispute with Argentina still rages on. But given the 1982 Falklands War and a subsequent referendum in which 99.8% of islanders voted to remain British, has Argentine repatriation become an unfeasible nationalistic shibboleth? One of the most vocal and high-profile populist parties in Europe, Italy's Five Star Movement, is set to split from the anti-EU political alliance at the European Parliament and join the pro-EU ALDE grouping in a move that will see funding for pro-Brexit UKIP slashed. But does the move also signal the demise of Euroscepticism, and how much will it undermine UKIP both politically and financially? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu remains under police investigation after being questioned by Israeli police for a second time last Friday. Investigators are probing whether the Israeli Premier was involved in corrupt and unethical practices involving payments of almost £1 million by two businessmen. But will the investigation be enough to bring down Netanyahu, who has been Prime Minister for 8 years? And just how did one Texan man find out the hard way that you shouldn't keep cat litter in your car? On January 3rd, 1833, the United Kingdom military forces expelled the population of the Malvinas and its legitimate Argentine authorities, replacing them with British subjects. Or at least that's the interpretation put forward by Argentina's foreign ministry this past week, as it marks the 184th anniversary of what it calls Britain's usurpation of the Malvinas Isles, and which have ever since been under British rule as the Falkland Islands. Jack Foster has this report.
Those isles of the sea are calling to me, smell of the campfire, dear memory. Though far I may roam, someday I'll come home to the islands of Falkland.
The unofficial anthem of the Falkland Islands, the Song of the Falklands, tells of a peaceful place of rugged beauty, but perhaps conspicuously doesn't touch on the more contentious status of the South Atlantic archipelago, whose 184th anniversary of British control was marked this week. Of course, whether that's a cause for celebration or commiseration depends very much on your perspective, or more specifically, whether you're British or Argentinian. This week's anniversary is generally marked in Argentina as that of the island's usurpation by colonial Britain of what is still referred to in Argentina as the Malvinas.
Las Malvinas.
Argentina has never accepted Britain's claim of sovereignty over the Falkland Malvinas, arguing that it acquired the Falklands from Spain when it achieved independence in 1816. And, of course, they have attempted to retake the territory by force, most notably in 1982. Here is the then UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher responding to the news that the capital Stanley had been taken by Argentine forces.
After several days of rising tension in our relations with Argentina, that country's armed forces attacked the Falkland Islands yesterday and established military control of the islands. I must tell the House that the Falkland Islands and their dependencies remain British territory. No aggression and no invasion can alter that simple fact. It is a government's objective to see that the islands are freed from occupation and are returned to British administration.
The Falklands War lasted 74 days and ended with the Argentine surrender on the 14th of June 1982, returning the islands to British control. In total, 649 Argentine military personnel, 255 British military personnel and three Falkland Islanders died during the hostilities. 3 years ago, in 2013, the islands held a referendum on the question, do you wish the Falkland Islands to retain their current political status as an overseas territory of the United Kingdom? And the result were pretty conclusive.
The turnout at the referendum was 92%. The number of yes votes cast was 1,513, which represents 98.8%.
The International Observation Mission has concluded that the voting process was executed in accordance with international standards and local laws.
Of those who voted in that referendum, only 3 voted against. But if you thought that that would put the issue to bed for good, you would be very wrong. Argentine governments have continued to claim sovereignty over the islands, and even the new administration of Mauricio Macri, noted for a considerably more pro-Western stance than his predecessors, hasn't let the question drop. Here's his foreign minister, Susana Malcora, speaking last year.
If there is a will, there is a way. I've learned that in the United Nations in dealing with very intractable problems. So that's where I stand now.
Argentine Foreign Minister Susana Malcora speaking last year on the subject of the Falklands Malvinas sovereignty. And over the past week, as the anniversary of British control over the islands passes once more, the Argentine Foreign Ministry has again urged the UK government to move forward with negotiations to resolve, once and for all, the long-running sovereignty dispute. Now, Alistair Pinkerton is a senior lecturer in geography and geopolitics at Royal Holloway University from London, and he was also an observer at the 2013 referendum. He joins me on the line now from London. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today, Dr. Pinkerton. Given the time frame of British control and the weight of support amongst islanders for the status quo, is the term sovereignty dispute perhaps overstating things a bit?
This is clearly a very long-standing dispute between the UK and Falkland Islanders and Argentina. In many ways, this is a dispute which seems to be becoming far less hostile than it has been in the past. I mean, there's been a whole host of recent and very positive actions and words coming from the Macri government in Argentina that suggests that Argentina are going to pursue their claim to the islands in a very different way to previous governments. There has been an agreement that is currently being signed, for example, to help identify the Argentine war dead who still remain on the islands from 1982 under the auspices of the Red Cross. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to suggest that Macri is a fundamentally different kind of leader to his predecessor, Mrs. Kirchner. But this is nonetheless still a very lively dispute, even if it might be a kind of inverted commas Cold War between the UK and Argentina. It's very clear that Argentine citizens become highly motivated around this subject, and particularly in early January when we have this kind of annual anniversary of a so-called usurpation. At least Argentina called this the usurpation of the islands. This gets celebrated or commemorated in January, but at other times of year as well. So, for example, during the supposed start and end dates of the 1982 invasion as well. So this is undoubtedly an active sovereignty dispute, but it's one that seems to rumble along without too much noise, except at particular points in the year.
You kind of hinted at it before there, but I mean, many heralded the shift in administrations as changing things. As you said, that the Kirchner years were notably more antagonistic with regards to Falkland Malvinas question. And the current Macri administration has undoubtedly presented a more Western-friendly face, certainly on a general range of issues. Why then is Susana Malcora continuing to argue this inviolable rights of sovereignty argument over the islands?
I think however progressive an Argentine government may be, there's, and we've seen this multiple times before in the past when you've had progressive Western-facing governments in Buenos Aires, there is still a need, as in most other liberal democracies, to kind of play to a national base. And it is very clear that Argentine subjects, Argentine citizens, are highly motivated on the point of the Malvinas. I mean, after all, this is the British, in inverted commas, occupation of the islands. It's something that is taught to Argentine school pupils from some of their earliest years in education. There is this lingering sense that Britain has robbed away an integral part of Argentina. And it's a very popular way, as Galtieri found, of course, also in 1982, of summoning up a kind of an Argentine nationalism, which can be highly popular. And after all, we do seem to be living in an era of populism.
So is it then the case that Argentine governments, regardless of what stripe they may be, this is just an issue that they can't afford to ignore in terms of keeping a certain amount of the electorate on side?
It would be political suicide, I think, for any Argentine government to fully ignore the Falklands Malvina's question. Undoubtedly, some have tried and some have failed in their political aspirations when doing that. And for all Macri's progressive, liberal, and in inverted commas, Western credentials, this is still an active sovereignty dispute. It's still something that of course, gets debated at the United Nations and is also something that has to be taken seriously, not least because of popular opinion in Argentina, but also because it is still an active question that the UN is considering.
So, I mean, do you think that realistically there's any opportunity that the sovereignty of the Falklands may change?
Well, I'd never say never. I don't believe that will happen. And I believe it won't happen for a number of reasons. In your introduction, you mentioned the referendum in 2013, and I was there to observe the referendum, and I watched it happening. And it was very clear the kind of public opinion that was being expressed at that particular point of time. Clearly, it was something in the region of 98-99% in favour of remaining a British overseas territory that was expressed at that particular moment. But I think it's a number of other reasons as well. I think the reality of sovereignty changing, if you think through the logical outcome of that, then it's very troubling indeed. You have a community who overwhelmingly voted to remain a British overseas territory. The prospect of them becoming Argentine citizens is a curious one. Argentina argues that the Falklands should be repatriated to Argentina on the basis of kind of lingering British colonialism. But the net effect of Argentina somehow taking over the islands would again be an act of colonialism, subjugating people against their will to the domination of a government that they don't welcome. So that would also be a deeply problematic outcome. So no, I can't see this changing at any point in the near future unless the collective will of Falkland Islanders fundamentally changed, and I can't see that happening.
So perhaps it's just destined to remain a sort of symbolic bone of contention between Argentina and the UK forever, maybe.
That's the way it certainly looks at the moment. But of course, clearly, the United Kingdom is now in a very different position to the one that it was in the recent past, where the security of being part of the European Union granted a certain amount of kind of diplomatic solidarity towards Britain from partner European states. Britain, of course, is now, particularly after Article 50 is triggered, is going to be out there in the wider world looking to negotiate new kinds of trading relationships. The British government have very clearly said that they would not consider in any way trading away, not that they're even able to do that, the Falkland Islands in order to gain better relationships with Latin America. But perhaps we are entering a new era of British pragmatism.
And I suppose, as you said before, never say never, and never has that been more true than in the wake of Brexit last year, which very few saw coming, I would say. Anyway,
indeed.
Dr. Alistair Pinkerton, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 32 minutes past the hour. It had been one of the strongest Eurosceptic political blocs in the European Parliament, but now the Europe of Freedom and Direct Democracy Alliance, currently chaired by UKIP's Nigel Farage, has been dealt a major blow after Italy's five-star movement leader, Beppe Grillo, urged a split from the group. The proposal, endorsed in an online poll of members held on Grillo's own blog, has followed an angry exchange of words between the leadership of UKIP and Five Star, with Farage accusing Grillo of joining the European elite. But does this development signal the end of what had been a growing Eurosceptic movement in the rest of Europe following the UK's decision last June to exit the EU? Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
One of Europe's most popular and prominent political parties, Italy's Five Star Movement, is to break away from the main Eurosceptic political alliance at the European Parliament in a move that could significantly slash funding for the pro-Brexit UK Independence Party. Beppe Grillo, the founder of Five Star, urged his party to end its membership of the Europe of Freedom and Direct Democracy Alliance, known as EFDD, and instead join the pro-EU alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe. But the move could end up costing UKIP, whose former leader Nigel Farage chairs the EFDD, over $1 million, as EU group funding is slashed, resulting from the loss of Five Star's 17 MEPs. In an angry statement issued on Monday, Farage accused his former political allies in Five Star of joining the EU establishment. So how damaging is the decision by Five Star to the broader Eurosceptic movement in Europe? Earlier I spoke to Dr. Daniel Albertazzi, a senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Birmingham, and I started by asking him if the decision by Five Star to break away may end up triggering a larger breakup of the Eurosceptic bloc at the European Parliament.
Well, in practical terms, of course, it would be a huge problem for Farage because he only needs now to lose one MEP from one of the other small groups, and then the group itself will not be able to exist anymore. Because you need a minimum number of MEPs, and also they need to come from a certain number of countries. So Farage is really on the verge on this one. But I wouldn't say that the issue of the five-star movement leaving is going to trigger necessarily anything in itself, because at least in my view, it wasn't driven by ideology. It was driven purely by other calculations having to do with the very relevant benefits that one gains by being a member of one of these groups, benefits that the five-star movement, despite being so large, would lose if it remained part of Farage's group, given that Farage won't be there and these people won't be there for very long now. So my view is that this wasn't driven by ideological reasons. It was driven by practical considerations. And I don't think that it will necessarily cause, you know, any other parties to follow suit, because, they need to kind of assess the situation themselves. But obviously the group, the EFDD, is in a kind of delicate position, because now we know that UKIP is soon going to lead. Well, they won't have MEPs there anymore. So,
do you think the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe will prove a natural home for Five Star politically and ideologically? And will it broaden the appeal of Five Star in Italy and make them appear more respectable, as some have suggested?
No, I'm very sceptical about that. I think that in Italy, like in many other countries, people care very little about what group the party they vote for has joined in the European Parliament. There is discussion among party members, and of course the Five Star Movement has had its fair share of discussions, but when you look at the electorate at large, people are not too bothered and not too worried. Now, as I said, my reading of it is that it was done for a number of practical and tactical reasons, not for ideological reasons. I don't think this is going to affect the direction of the Five Star Movement. We also need to keep in mind that it has never been a right-wing populist party. So it was actually quite strange, if you want, in ideological terms only, it was strange for them to join Farage. And this was very controversial when it was done, and there was, again, a lot of discussion because some people within the movement felt that Farage was far too much to the right. We have to keep in mind that, you know, when it comes to Five Star, they are not in the center, and they are not in the right, and they are not on the left. They are really, nobody can classify them, because you can't really synthesize what their position is on many issues. If you look at Five Star in Bologna, it's completely different from Five Star in Turin, and that's completely different from Five Star in Rome. So when it comes to kind of saying what Five Star is about, I mean, it's clearly about fighting the political class and corruption. But apart from that, there is a lot that is actually controversial. So the proposals on immigration are kind of looking to the right, but they are controversial within the movement itself. They have a lot of attention to green issues, but the Greens didn't want them in their group because of what they say about immigration mainly. It's very, very difficult to kind of categorize. But is this the beginning of the Five Star becoming moderate? I don't think so. Do people care in Italy? I don't think so.
And you touched on their position on corruption. There has been some allegations that UKIP misused EFDD funds, and this was perhaps seen as another factor driving Grillo's decision to break away from this political bloc. How big a factor do you think that has been in persuading him to pursue this proposal?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I was talking about kind of tactical considerations. I think that might well have been an important factor. They Five-star movement is in trouble, as I'm sure you know. Rome has been supposedly running Rome for well over 6 months, 7 months. In reality, they haven't run very little so far. I mean, they haven't really done very much. But there has been a number of scandals in Rome, and people resigning and people being investigated. And that is really the single thing, the most important thing that the Five-Star Movement doesn't need. As I said, they can change position on many issues, and there are certainly people within the movement who are right-wing, and a lot of people are left-wing, the majority are left-wing. Others reject the two categories, left and right, completely. But he says one thing that defines them is the fight against corruption. So being opposed to a political class that in Italy, you can say with very good reason, has been, well, not all of them, of course, but many of them have been corrupted and they haven't run the country particularly well in the last decades. Now, if you take this away from them and if they can't use this to differentiate themselves from others, then basically they are finished. And that's why, yes, I think what you mentioned was a factor. And second, what is happening in Rome is very, very important, because if they lose this kind of image of the parties that are completely different from all the others, I think this would be the end of them. And Grillo knows it.
Dr. Daniel Albertazzi, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It is 40 minutes past the hour. He is set to become the longest-serving Israeli Prime Minister of all time, but Benjamin Netanyahu's place in the history books may be scuppered if a major police investigation leads to a conviction for corruption in public office. The Israeli Prime Minister is no stranger to controversy over corruption allegations, but as our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out, this ongoing police investigation may prove enough to bring down Netanyahu and leave a political vacuum at the top of the Israeli political establishment.
It's not a crime to receive cigars from a friend. That was the rather glib statement given by Yaakov Weinroth, attorney to Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, after his client was interrogated for a second time over corruption allegations involving Israeli and foreign businessmen. Netanyahu is currently facing two criminal police investigations, the first into whether he accepted cash gifts from business figures in return for political favours. The second, more serious investigation, involves the so-called Case 2000. Although the exact details of the Case 2000 investigation have yet to be made public, it is believed this probe, which involves the Prime Minister's relations with another wealthy Israeli newspaper publisher, could prove the biggest threat to Netanyahu's reign. Over the weekend, Israeli media claimed a series of audio tapes they had obtained appeared to confirm suspicions that Netanyahu was collaborating with business figures in return for political favours. Well, joining us now to discuss this is Professor Niamh Gordon, a professor of politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Professor Gordon, welcome to World in Focus. The details are still a bit sketchy about the nature and direction of this police investigation, but how significant do you think it is that officers spent over 4 hours interviewing Prime Minister Netanyahu under caution on Thursday, and is there any indication the probe could be politically motivated?
I don't think the probe is politically motivated, and I think that this morning we know more than we knew on Thursday. There are basically two central cases against him. One has to do with the presence that he received from a number of people, he and his family, and we're talking about presents that amount to probably something like £100,000. And we know of one case of a person that gave him a present and wanted a visa, a 10-year visa from Israel to the United States. And we know that Prime Minister Netanyahu talked to Secretary of State John Kerry in order to organize this visa. Mm-hmm. And so we see a kind of almost bribery of a person giving presents to Netanyahu and his children, and then Netanyahu calling the Secretary of State to get a visa. The second case, which is much broader and potentially even more harmful, is an agreement or at least discussions between Netanyahu and the publisher of Israel's most powerful newspaper, Yediot Ahronot. And the publisher of the paper asked Netanyahu to clamp down on another paper and restrict its sales in different ways. And in return, the coverage that Netanyahu would get in his paper would be not as damaging and not as critical. And so here we see again a kind of relationship between big money and government. And I think these are serious allegations. The question is whether Netanyahu will get out of them or not. I don't know.
And Netanyahu's supporters appear to be rallying around the Prime Minister and have said that even if he was charged, he would remain in office. Do you think it is conceivable, and again, we don't know the full details, that he could be forced to go or at least be forced to temporarily stand down?
If he is charged, I think he'll be forced to leave office. The question, though, is if charges are actually made, and that's the crucial question. And his lawyers and a lot of politicians are trying to spin it and say that it's not a big deal. But actually, Olmert, who is now in jail, Israel's former prime minister, for bribes and allegations such as these, I think the cases are in some way similar. And I think there is a chance that the charges will be made, but I don't know.
And the Israeli prime minister, he's known for his combative style and approach, and he's faced controversy in the past. But what's your reading of the way that he has handled this threat to his leadership? And do you think that he'll be worried given the character of his premiership?
I think he probably will, and I think what he usually does is try to kind of deflect it by creating other newsworthy issues. So what we might see in the coming days is an attack on the Palestinians or criticism against the Iranians or something of the sort that kind of uses different spin doctors to take the public eye away from his investigations onto other issues. And that's what I'm a bit fearful of.
And one of the big questions arising from this speculation over whether he will fulfill his premiership and become Israel's longest-serving prime minister is that even if he is forced to go, there's no obvious choice as a replacement at the moment, is there?
No, and the choices that are not good either. It's probably the person that's highest in the polls now is Yair Lapid, who's a kind of neoliberal ideologist with a right-wing agenda. And so it's not as if you have a kind of leader that can move Israel away from its rights abusive policies towards the Palestinian and its neoliberal agenda against its poor into a kind of more moral leadership. I don't see that in the... But, you know, politics is often very surprising, and for the good and for the bad. In 2016, we were surprised a lot for the bad. Maybe in 2017, there will be good surprise.
And as you mentioned just a moment ago, this is not the first time a senior Israeli figure has faced serious corruption investigations. But how damaging do you think these kinds of investigations are to the international reputation of Israel and the perception of the Israeli political leadership?
I don't think they're that damaging. I mean, corruption in politics is something that I think happens in most countries around the world. We see it today in the United States. We saw it before in the United States with the Cheney and Halliburton in the Bush administration. We've seen it here in the UK and, of course, in France and other countries. And so I don't think that will in any way harm Israel's reputation more than it is already harmed through its treatment of the Palestinian people.
Professor Niamh Gordon, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, Germany has threatened to end development aid to countries that refuse to take back rejected asylum seekers. It comes at a time of growing debate in the country over issues of security and immigration. We've more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. every day right here on Radio Sputnik. We'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day right here on Radio Sputnik.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Germany has threatened to end development aid to countries that refuse to take back rejected asylum seekers. The warning is a response to the failure to deport the suspected Berlin attacker to Tunisia. It comes at a time of growing debate in the country over issues of security and immigration. And we'll be discussing how one Texan man found out the hard way that you shouldn't keep cat litter in your car. Germany has threatened to end development aid to countries that refuse to take back rejected asylum seekers. The warning is a response to the failure to deport the suspected Berlin attacker to Tunisia. The comments were made by Vice-Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel in an interview with Der Spiegel over the weekend. The man suspected of ploughing a lorry into the Berlin Christmas market last month and his Emery was Tunisian, but the country had earlier denied that this was his home nation. For more on this, here's Liam O'Hare.
Well, this threat comes at a time of heightened debate about security and immigration in the country. An election will be held in the country later in the year, with the far-right Alternative for Germany party expected to perform very well. Well, earlier I was joined by the journalist and commentator Mark Bergfeld. I asked him for his response to the Vice-Chancellor's comments.
The fact that Vice-Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel now threatens to cut aid for countries who do not accept asylum seekers to return back to their countries misses a crucial point, that one of the main reasons why people are migrating to Germany in the first place is the lack of opportunities, economic opportunities as well as job opportunities in those countries. So actually what we need to think about is something of a Marshall Plan for those countries in the global south that can actually tackle the roots of the current migration and refugee crisis on the one hand. Secondly, this kind of sanctioning from the government is just another dog whistle to voters who are at the moment leaving all mainstream political parties to go and vote for the AfD. So on the inside in Germany, you see how political parties are outdoing each other on security measures, whether it's installing more cameras in public spaces or whether it is demanding quicker procedures of deportation. And the Sigmar Gabriel's latest announcement just chimes with those very measures as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to ask you as well. What does this say about just the climate of security and how terrorism is being looked at and is becoming such a predominant issue in Germany just now? Is this the issue that's going to dominate the upcoming election this year?
A recent poll by InfraTestimap shows that that all voters from all mainstream political parties, whether it's Die Linke, the SPD, the Green Party, or the CDU, or the FDP, actually do not feel threatened or do not feel insecure after the attacks on the Berlin Christmas market in December. What we, however, see is a divergence on the question of the AfD, that the AfD voters and sympathizers and party members do feel more insecure. And it's very obvious that they are playing on the kinds of fears generated by the attacks on the Berlin Christmas market, and that the parties that are responding, the CDU and the SPD, are now responding by playing into the fear because they realize that more and more voters are leaving for the AfD. And so the only way to do that is by kind of undermining the kind of fear that exists within that section of society. I don't think it is a reliable strategy to winning back those voters, because the two mainstream political parties currently governing Germany have been governing since 2005, respectively. And so it means that they are actually partially responsible for the kind of political events and occurrences which have happened over the last couple of years.
And we've obviously seen these shocks across Europe, indeed with Brexit and the United States as well, with the election of Donald Trump and the rise of the populist right. Do you believe that Angela Merkel could remain immune from that, or do you think her coalition is in danger in the election later this year?
The same kind of political phenomena which we have seen occur in Britain, which we see with the election of Donald Trump in the United States, or we see with the rise of Marine Le Pen and the Front National in France, we're also seeing in Germany at this moment. However, it's not a situation of a simple shift to the right by all voters, but we see a polarization manifesting itself, where those parties in the extreme center are actually, you know, targeting voters with mainstream political ideologies, are trying to occupy the center ground while opening up the spaces both to the left and to the right. At the moment, it appears that the right, the AfD, is winning those votes, but at the same time, there is a possibility for the left to also make strides forward in this political climate if it proposes different political alternatives to the governing coalition.
And just lastly, Mark, obviously that's specific to Germany, but when you look across Europe, you look at, like you mentioned, Marine Le Pen and the rise of the Front National, how much do you think the EU principles of freedom of movement within the European borders, of course, are now becoming under threat from the rise of the far right?
What we see since September 2015, when Merkel opened up the German border to 1 million Syrian refugees and provided them with asylum, we saw countries across Eastern Europe in particular say no to allowing refugees to come in, and thus also breaking with the Geneva Convention. We saw that neither France nor Britain actually wanted to take responsibility for the refugees. But what we're also seeing at the same time is that the freedom of movement for EU nationals is increasingly coming under threat through, for example, the curtailment of benefits for EU citizens, of such as Polish migrants in Britain or Spanish migrants in Germany. Those are being curtailed, thus undermining the principle of freedom of movement. And so I think what we will see is a re-entrenchment of the nation state in the foreseeable future, if the political rise of the far right, such as the AfD, continues within the next couple of months and years.
Well, Mark Bergfeld, we really appreciate getting your thoughts today. Thanks so much for joining us on World in Focus.
Yeah, thank you, Liam.
And finally, don't keep cat litter in your car is the lesson that Texan Ross LeBeau learnt the hard way. LeBeau was arrested in December and held in custody for 3 days while police ran tests on what they thought was around half a pound of crystal meth they found inside an old sock in the young man's car. The sock was actually filled with cat litter. His father had given him the filled sock as a way of stopping the car's windows from steaming up with condensation. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Radio Sputnik.
Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution is teetering on the brink of destruction. Inflation is climbing up towards 1,000%. The national currency, the Bolivar, is worthless. Food shortages of basic medicine and other essentials. Corruption in the army. Crime spiked. This bears all the hallmarks of another failed socialist experiment. Or at least that's what the Western media would have us believe. But is it something else? Is something else going on in Venezuela? Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.